Perfect. So this is a supplemental podcast that we're doing. We have a couple gentlemen from Wild Sheep Foundation that were nice enough to jump in with us and record. And we want to talk about wild sheep. I want to talk about Wild Sheep Foundation. And then also as it relates to our little project that we picked up, I tried to get Omar to jump on today, but it seems he's too busy for us. But we're trying
he's
to...
He's probably running.
That's right.
getting his miles in.
He's probably running. That's probably it. But yeah, Omar had a cool idea. He was trying to run an ultra 100-mile race. And as part of that, he wanted to do some conservation and linked up with you guys. You guys were generous to donate to his cause. And we're going to try to build a sheep guzzler here in Southern Nevada for bighorn sheep. So we want to talk a little bit about that and your involvement and just how funding, you know, how funding works for wild sheep. So we appreciate you guys jumping on, but I guess before I get going too deep, can I get an introduction for you guys? So we have Corey Mason and Kevin Hurley, and maybe Corey, if first and foremost, can I have you jump in and just give us an intro as to who you are and what you do and where you're from?
Yeah, you bet. Thanks guys for having us. We appreciate that. So yeah, Corey Mason, live in Texas, worked the first half of my career for State Fish and Wildlife Agency, and now serve as COO and Executive VP of Conservation, and get to work alongside Mr. Hurley every day.
How long have you been in the job?
I joined Wild Sheep Foundation in August.
Okay, relatively new.
I'm relatively new to Wild Sheep, but have been in the conservation space for 25 plus years. So,
gotcha. What were you doing prior to Wild Sheep?
Yeah, so I worked as CEO of Dallas Safari Club before that, and then 16 plus years with Texas Parks and Wildlife as a biologist for the agency.
Gotcha. There's probably, how many people do you think are aware that, you know, the Texas has wild sheep, desert sheep, and actually you guys allocate permits to hunt sheep in Texas?
Yeah, it's a little known resource, that's for sure, in the state of Texas. Mm-hmm.
For sure, but super cool. Yeah, absolutely. Kevin, how about you?
Well, VP for Conservation Emeritus, which means I'm an old dude on the way out, but I'm not gone yet. I spent my 30-year career with the state of Wyoming Game and Fish Department, and my involvement with FNAWS, the Foundation for North American Wild Sheep, which is now the Wild Sheep Foundation, goes back to fall of 1981. So 44 plus years, and FNAWS funded my graduate work at the University of Wyoming on a sheep study between Cody and Yellowstone Park. And so I've been on the staff for the Wild Sheep Foundation 14 plus years, and pretty much a lifetime.
Gotcha. So I'm curious if both of you wanted to ask, what is it about wild sheep that drew you to it? What is it about wild sheep and wild sheep species and habitat? I mean, we talked to a lot of people. I wouldn't say that I have it yet, but inevitably anybody, if you talk to enough hunters, you know, they'll tell you that people have sheep fever. So what is sheep fever and why do you guys seem to have it so bad?
Let me take a shot at that, because when I was headed to Laramie, Wyoming for my graduate project, the funding fell through. I was going to work on a mule deer project and the money disappeared. Are you guys hearing a lot of feedback? I sure am. But I got to Laramie and the money wasn't there. And I thought, oh crap, now what? So I started beating the streets, going over to Game and Fish in Cheyenne, talked to them about possible other species to work on, elk, moose, bears, whatever. And they had interest in a couple of bighorn sheep projects in Wyoming. And so that's how I got started. Again, in the fall of 81, and I found this organization back then, the acronym, it still is, it's FNAWS. What's a FNAWS? Well, it's the Foundation for North American Wild Sheep. And that's our organization. And we were founded in 1974, but incorporated in 1977. So in 2 years, we're coming up on our 50th anniversary. But that's what got me going. And I wrote up two study proposals, one in the North Platte River drainage in southeast Wyoming, and one in the Absaroka Range above Cody. And the Sheep Foundation at the time was recipient of some of the early Wyoming governor's bighorn sheep permits. And so based on the auction of those, I went back to FNAS and said, where would you like me to work? And they said, how about Cody? I said, you bet, where's Cody? So I'd never been to Cody, but I'm so glad I did. I consider Cody my home. I've lived there longer than anywhere. But to me, sheep are, man, like you said, they're everybody's pinnacle, what to hope to hunt someday. And, you know, after my retirement from Wyoming Game and Fish, I went on 3 sheep hunts in 4 years. And I spent way too much money, but I was freshly divorced. And so I drugged my college-age kids, and we went sheep hunting. I thought, boy, if I'm going to try to manage or conserve these things, I want to experience what other people have experienced. I had hunted in Wyoming, but I was able to go to Alaska, the Yukon, and Mexico to get my 4 sheep. And so that's what got me going. And every day, I've been a biologist 48 years. I learned something about wild sheep every day. And that's what turns my crank, gets me up in the morning, and gets going.
Gotcha. What, and I'm curious, is it wild sheep? What, I mean, would, do you, and I assume that you guys probably have an answer to this, but what is the history of wild sheep? If you could just, and I know this is a broader question that I can probably ask and what we've got time for, but I'm curious as to what is the history of wild sheep in the U.S.? Where were we at historically? Where are we at now? And this is a loaded question, obviously, but like, where do you think we're headed with wild sheep?
Corey, I can take a swing at that if you're good.
Yeah, go right ahead.
So one of the absolute Bibles that I've referred to 1,000 times in the last 45 years, in 1960, there was a researcher at Cal Berkeley by the name of Helmut Buchner, and he put out a monograph called Bighorn Sheep of the United States, Past and Present. And he didn't speculate about the future, but it's a really cool document if people can find it online, because he's got early accounts from each jurisdiction that had sheep in it. If you go back to the earliest estimates, there was a naturalist, Ernest Thompson Seton, in 1928, he published a series of manuals about the lives of game animals. And Seton's estimate for mountain sheep in the West was 1.5 to 2 million. And that was based on his hip pocket and his, you know, back of the napkin calculations. And there's no way that he surveyed or censused sheep all over the Western US. But what we know now about fine scale habitat selection and densities, you know, there's some people that say that was 3 to 4 times higher than what could possibly be sustained. Regardless, we can't argue about that, but it's fair to say that bighorn sheep are reduced by 99% or more. If Buchner's estimate was correct at 2 million, we're down, you know, we got to as low in the US as 15,000 in Buchner's monograph written in 1960. So this was based on work he did in the 50s. And if you look around the West, and we've got a great graphic, we took Buchner's range map for bighorn sheep in 1850, and then he had one in 1960, and there's a dramatic difference. For example, Buchner considered the state of Nevada, the entire state, to be occupied bighorn range. Well, we know that's not quite accurate, but he obviously drew with a big thick crayon back then, where now it's fine scale mapping, you know, GIS mapping, very detailed. Bottom line is, whatever the number was prior to European settlement, it got to a low of 15 to 17,000 in the Western states. This is excluding Mexico, excluding Canada, Alberta and British Columbia. Now we think that bighorn numbers, desert bighorn in the states, Rocky Mountain bighorn, California bighorn, there's probably 85 to 90,000. So we're maybe three times the low point. You know, if it got down to 25,000, counting BC, counting Alberta and the Western states, maybe there's three to four times that now, but it's a long ways from 2 million spread out all over the West, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. What, in regards to threats, and some of these are answers that I might know the answer to, but in terms of threats to wild sheep, what would you say the biggest threats are? And then how do we deal with it?
Boy, how many hours is this podcast? No, seriously, I'm putting together a talk that I'm giving, not next week, the week after in Arizona, at the every other year meeting of what's called the Desert Bighorn Council. And I have not worked in Desert Bighorn country all that much. Much of what I've learned is from a compadre of Corey's from Texas, Clay Brewer. He worked for Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and was really the heart and soul behind the restoration of Desert Bighorn in West Texas for a long time. He retired. He worked on our staff for a while. He's still available on some contract stuff. But what they asked me to give a keynote address in 2 weeks is, what were the challenges then and opportunities? What are the challenges and opportunities now? And project out 75 years. What's it going to look like? And man, I wish my crystal ball was that clear. I would have probably bought some bonds last week before the stock market roller coaster ride, if my crystal ball was that accurate. But in the very first transactions of what's called the Desert Bighorn Council, in prep for this talk, I went through and I looked at what are the limiting factors that were identified by those early managers and researchers. And a lot of it stemmed around competition for forage, and that might have been with deer, which a lot of people now go, deer don't really eat the same thing that sheep do. Feral horses and burros. Back then, burros were a real issue. This was way before the 1971 Horse and Burro Act, but burros were a problem. A lot of Park Service land, Grand Canyon, Death Valley, different places had burro problems back then. Disease is always an issue. Bighorn sheep, as hardy as they are in the places they live, from a respiratory standpoint, they're pretty wimpy. And people have always asked me, what do you mean by that? It's like, well, if you look at them sideways, they'll start coughing and keel over. But there are respiratory pathogens that domestic sheep and domestic goats carry and can transfer. And so a lot of times that results in pneumonia in bighorn sheep. Now, it might be a light die-off. You know, you lose a third of the herd. It might be an all-age die-off where you lose 90 to 100% of the population. It compromises lamb recruitment because those mothers, they're still shedding the bacteria and the lambs have no natural immunity. And so as soon as they stop weaning, they get sick and die. So, I mean, there's predation, everything from coyotes and golden eagles to mountain lions in some places. But, I mean, there's a whole suite of challenges that these guys identified in 1957 in the first transactions. But if I look at it now around the West, it's a lot of the same challenges. You know, a place like Nevada, where Go Hunt's based out of, look how dry it is, driest state in the nation. How many days since you guys got any rain? 200 days, 200 plus days?
And yeah, it's been a while.
You know, to me, Nevada has a lot of challenges with feral horses and burros, and the Bureau of Land Management is trying. You know, I guess I won't say we, I'll say my personal opinion is Congress made this in 1971. Congress is responsible for addressing this issue, but it's such a hot topic. You don't get a lot of congressionals that are willing to take this on, but man, the BLM's trying and they're playing with the hand dealt to them. We get that. But horses and burros are a challenge. In fact, there's 7 times the biomass on the landscape of horses and burros in Nevada compared to all the native ungulates. If you combine the elk, the deer, the pronghorn, the bighorn together, there's way too many horses there. So those kind of challenges. In addition to water, you've got forage challenges. You know, if it doesn't rain, nothing's growing. So, you know, what are they eating? And there's still the whole disease and pathogen risk that desert bighorn face. So that's a mouthful, but
I thought it was interesting too, on the last call we had, right where we were ending, we were talking about these coyotes chasing some sheep. And then I saw just the last week you guys posted a little video clip of that coyote doing that. And it's like, that was something you always hear about it. But I was like, didn't know how much a coyote actually impacts, you know, maybe desert sheep population. But is that something that's actually, does that happen quite a bit that, you know, coyotes will go and, you know, try to take down a ram or you or some lambs, or is it kind of a one-off thing? Or,
you know, you hear the conventional wisdom says that the coyotes are hardest on lambs, but obviously based on that footage and a whole lot of other observations that people have had and shared, I think that video has been seen a million times on various social media platforms. But yeah, opportunistically, they'll damn sure take a ewe or try to take a ewe or a ram. You know, I've heard stories of golden eagles dive bombing rams and rams up on their hind feet like a stud horse trying to fend them off. So golden eagles, some people say they're a serious predator. Like in Alaska, a third of the known doll sheep lamb mortalities are due to golden eagle predation. What is it in the Southwest? I don't know the data and the percentages, but it's a real issue. Mountain lions, I found this interesting. Places that you'd think would have had mountain lion predation on desert bighorn, these guys wrote in their manuscripts 68 years ago, we haven't seen a mountain lion track. And so there's some, again, conventional wisdom and learning that's come out of places like New Mexico, that where you have mule deer and bighorn, it's kind of a subsidized predator. And so around Bishop in California, Round Valley, they've got mule deer and bighorn. Well, those mountain lions will darn sure take a bighorn if they get a chance, but they're living off of mule deer. And so back before, when deer numbers were really down low, there weren't any mountain lions in a lot of this desert range, but there are now because of a deer, sort of a subsidized diet, prey switching that goes on.
What's the gestational period of wild sheep, and what's their reproduction like?
Well, again, I'm going to say it's approximately 6 months. I think 173 days is the figure that comes to mind, but it's pretty rare that they twin. And in fact, in some wild sheep ranges that are nutritionally stressed, they have an alternate year reproductive strategy. You know, the females just can't muster enough energy to crank out a lamb every year. And so places like Alaska came up with that alternate year reproduction theory 25, 30 years ago. And I think it's now being seen in stone sheep range that, yeah, they don't necessarily have a lamb every year, even if they're prime age ewe. And so in Nevada or desert bighorn range, if they're nutritionally challenged, might that result in some kind of switch off? So we're not going to try to have a lamb every year. We got to regroup and skip a year. Don't know.
The other question I had in regards to reproduction is when does a ewe reach maturity where she can actually reproduce, and then how long lived are they?
Let me do the second half of that question, Corey, if I can. First, I've heard of 17 and 18 year old ewes. Wyoming. There were some old neck banded ewes. It's like, man, they were 17, 18 years old. I can't say that I've heard of anything living to be 20, but I suppose it's possible. And of course, rams, whether you're in a national park with no hunting or outside a park where there's hunting, it's a different scenario. In Wyoming, we used to think if you got an 11-year-old ram, that was a pretty old ram. And so, I'm comfortable in saying, you know, a 14-year-old ram is possible, but pretty rare. And so that was the second half of your question. Remind me again the first half, if you would.
Yeah, I was just wondering, like, how long are they actually reproductive? So a ewe, how many years will she actually produce a lamb? So if she lives to be, we'll say, an average of like 15, right? 14, 15. How many of those years may she produce actually? And I guess if she only produces like every other year, she may only produce 3-4 lambs ever, maybe? Is that wrong to say or think?
They're sexually mature, and they've demonstrated this in Alberta intentionally at a place called Ram Mountain, where they really went in and reduced bighorn sheep numbers. And the term is primiparity, and basically it's the age at first reproduction. And what they showed was on this Ram Mountain situation, when population density was lowered, those ewes could conceive at a year and a half of age. And so they would have their first lamb, you know, a year sooner than when population density was higher, and they would defer that so they'd have their first lamb when they were 3 instead of 2. And just for convenience purposes, I always use June 1 as the drop date, the start of the biological year, birth year. And I realize it varies. Hell, in Nevada, they're already done lambing, been done lambing for quite a while. Texas, I don't know when they lamb there, but it's done now. But so say a typical bighorn ewe would have her first lamb at age 3. And if she lives to be 15, she could have 10 or 12 lambs. Do they all survive? Not readily, not universally.
Gotcha. So,
but the potential is there, but twinning is pretty rare.
Right. Yeah. Can we go back to, is kind of the biggest bottleneck, and I don't know if it's the biggest perchance, because you actually mentioned several things that could potentially harm, you know, the growth and the expansion of sheep herds. But the one that I think most people are aware of or that they hear about is disease. So pneumonia, right? So you brought it up that, like, if you you look at a sheep sideways, you know, they tip over dead. What really can be done about disease? And is there anything that you're aware of on the horizon, you know, that could potentially, you know, help sheep be more genetically resistant to pneumonia, to diseases? Is there anything
let me ask Corey, you know, Corey, with your awareness of what's gone on in Texas, and for years, Texas didn't have respiratory pneumonia in their sheep, but now they do. So give an example maybe of what's gone on in Texas over the last 2-3 years.
Yeah, so not only do you have resource competition that's occurring, of course, in Texas specifically with an exotic and very invasive species, an Audat or Barbary sheep, you have, and again, in addition to the resource competition, you have this same conflict that occurs with domestic sheep. And so you have a species, an Audat, that reproduces extremely fast and extremely efficiently, probably outcompetes on a predator side as well because of the band concept, large herds of Audat, the ability to evade predators better, alert better, all that sort of evasive opportunities rather than small bands of sheep. And so the challenge to desert bighorn sheep in Texas has been numerous, meaning you have disease interaction there with pneumonia, and then you have resource competition. And so you have a number of extrinsic and intrinsic factors there that are really stacked against desert bighorn sheep. And so you've seen numbers now that are 25% what they were just a decade ago. And so the challenges are real. And now I'll let Kevin speak to the to your specific question about sort of ways to deal with the disease and then future opportunities.
You know, there's been work done. I think back to Idaho Department of Fish and Game back in the 80s. They had a project looking at, is there some genetic makeup or some genetic variable that some sheep are more differentially resistant to these respiratory pneumonia or bacteria? And indeed, they identified one, and I'm not a geneticist or a microbiologist, but they call it the NRAMP gene, and it's a long, NRAMP is just a way shorter term than what they found. But, you know, those of us who were outside of Idaho Fish and Game and outside of Idaho were looking at that going, now, wait a minute. Okay, so you may identify some genetic trait here, but if you say, in, you know, we're not advocating for captivity at all, but if you could somehow isolate that gene that favored resistance to these respiratory bacteria, well, we should have a lot more bighorns with that gene on the landscape. But to me, it's a genotypic, phenotypic question. What are you trading off? You know, it's like, well, okay, so they may be, you know, have some NRAMP gene that conveys differential resistance, but, you know, both their horns go the same direction, you know, some weird genetic anomaly. And so what's being done, it's kind of a buzzword in our world for the last several years. You guys may have heard the term test and remove. Well, what does test and remove mean? And so this is based on long-term work, two decades, three decades worth of work that started in Hell's Canyon, a long linear canyon between Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. I analogize that to a pearl necklace. You've got a long linear canyon, and you've got little nodes of sheep. Well, if you go back and look over the last 50, 60 years, there have been sheep released in Hell's Canyon from at least a dozen different sources, all the way from Alberta, Wyoming, a bunch of different places. And I heard Dr. Mike Miller, who was, he's a retired wildlife vet for Colorado Parks and Wildlife. He said, what happens when you put 12 kids in a daycare and close the door and let them wrestle and, you know, blow snot on each other and transfer cooties? Did we do some of this ourselves because we were mixing source herds instead of kind of keeping it clean and we're only going to get them from one place? Well, and by no means am I criticizing our predecessors, because if you think back to what guys did in the 50s and 60s and 70s, they did the best they could with the knowledge they had. But now there are a number of Western jurisdictions that are really careful, and they may not do any sheep transplants because of that pathogen mix. You put them all together, hit the blend key. And so I know places are looking really hard. You better know your pathogen profile in your source herd as well as your recipient herd, because you may inadvertently bring something in via transplant, a bighorn, that, boom, causes problems. I know Montana's had that situation happen, and it's happened elsewhere. So a lot more care and a lot more pre and post pathogen assessment, rather than just, well, let's just run out there and let's grab 20 sheep over here and move them over there.
Yeah. So and all that costs money, right?
You bet. I mean, transplants, you know, years ago, Gray Thornton, our president and CEO, he asked me, what does it cost to move a sheep? And I said, well, you're talking the helicopter cost, the diagnostic lab work, the radio collar itself. What? And so he gave me some sideboards, and I came up with a figure of about $5,000 a sheep. To, you know, and our motto is, for a long time, the Wild Sheep, or Fanaud's motto was putting more sheep on the mountain. Well, like a lot of things through time, that's evolved. So now our mission statement and our motto is putting and keeping sheep on the mountain. And you could really expand that and go, well, we only want healthy sheep on healthy mountains. We want to keep them healthy and keep them there. And so, you know, there's, like I said earlier, there's a whole lot of unoccupied range that's still suitable, but just running out and doing transplants like they did in the 70s, 80s, 90s, it's harder to do. And frankly, a lot of places that used to give sheep away don't want to. Texas, I look at Corey's home state there in Texas, and I put together some figures that Texas had gotten 12 imports of 81 sheep, desert sheep, from four or five different sources, Utah, Arizona, Nevada. Well, when Texas, if Texas winked out, and I'm reading this really cool book, it's called Rimrock Man. It's the story of a guy named Birch Carson. Back in 1940 and 41, two mules and three dogs, and that guy covered sheep country in West Texas. It was phenomenal. And Clay Brewer, our friend and colleague who I mentioned earlier, he's told me through the years, he said, I know I was standing in a spot that no man had ever stood in before, and I look over and on a rock face, there's W.B. Carson, 1940, etched into the stone. It's like, son of a gun, that guy was everywhere. But it's, you know, those guys were tough. I mean, no getting around it. But they had so many challenges. Texas, they said bighorn sheep, desert bighorn sheep in Texas were gone by 1903. And you know, virtually gone. I shouldn't say totally gone. His estimates in 1937, Carson figured there was maybe 300. And then by 1940, he said we're down to 75. And by 1941, he said we're at 35. And if three data points make a trend, that's not a very good line. And so, and again, Corey's going to know with his TPWD background and Texas background, in the 50s, Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and our affiliate down there, the Texas Bighorn Society, got back in the restoration effort in West Texas. Grew it back to probably higher than historic numbers, 1,500, 1,600, 1,800 bighorn. And now it's down to what, Corey, 450? And so what happened then? You know, Carson, he thought a lot of it had to do with domestic sheep, pathogen transmission. But like Corey said, Audad inadvertently, you know, Texas Parks and Wildlife released Audad in Paladuro Canyon in the 50s. And now there's how many more, way more Audad in West Texas than, I mean, like 20, 25,000, whatever the numbers and estimates are. It's incredible. And like Corey said earlier, they breed like rabbits. They can twin. They can have two litters a year. And
what's your thought, Corey, on Audad, and in regards to wild sheep populations? And you know, would you like to see more management? Is it even feasible? I'm just curious as to what your opinion is on Audad.
No, that's an insightful question. I appreciate that. I think if there is a desire for desert bighorn sheep to exist in what is used, Texas is the sort of confined boundary there, I think massive Audad eradication is the only way to do so. They cannot really coexist. Again, Audad outcompete. They transfer disease. Their reproductive rate is exponentially higher. And there has to be significant reduction of Audad for desert bighorn sheep to have a chance at surviving. And it's pretty black and white, you know, and there's a challenge there, of course, with management from a financial standpoint, from a landowner's view, with I mean, Texas being one of the very few states that, you know, most of the wild sheep occur, I should say some portion of the wild sheep occur on private lands. Again, a unique model. So the private landowner ultimately makes the decision of how they manage that property, what competition of resources looks like, stocking rates of livestock, et cetera, to the betterment or to the detriment of wild sheep populations. And so, but for wild sheep population to have a chance, there really has to be an exclusion from AWDAD, and it has to be a pretty significant effort, which can, and there's some that are willing to try to achieve that. So the coexistence, that's not a happy future for desert bighorn sheep. Rather, it has to be significant eradication to remove all that from the landscape for desert bighorn sheep to have a good chance. And Kevin and I were in Texas in December for a very significant project to relocate 77 desert bighorn sheep from a WMA that's been largely isolated from AWDAD with a few engagements here and there, but is a disease-free herd, and then move those sheep to another mountain range that is free of AWDAD at this point in time. So that was a significant victory. And it takes that kind of planning and advanced work, I think, to safeguard that resource.
Yeah, the unique part about that transplant, though, is the Franklin Mountains north of El Paso was identified as the last mountain range in West Texas that didn't have AWDAD in. And so that certainly was a consideration in TPWD's decision to try to transplant sheep off of Elephant Mountain, south of Alpine, all the way over to the Franklin Mountains State Park, north of El Paso.
Are AWDAD susceptible to pneumonia? Do they like show it, or they, or could they carry it and then pass it on to desert bighorns?
Like they might not get the latter. And there's some really good work that we helped fund along with a lot of other partners at Texas A&M, Dr. Walt Cook, who used to be the wildlife vet for the state of Wyoming Game and Fish Department. He's a professor at A&M, and he and his grad students worked on that transmission. And so they isolated and then co-penned, you know, some AWDAD and some desert bighorn. And the desert bighorn carried various strains of MOV, this Mycoplasma ovipositor. Everybody calls it MOV for short, but it's kind of the setup artist, the bacteria that compromises the airwave. And so the AWDAD weren't dying from it, but right next door, the desert bighorn were. Now, they looked at shared water. You know, was there a stream or something going through? Did they share a water tank? And so AWDAD have been now demonstrated to carry and transmit that pathogen, but they're not as susceptible as desert bighorn are. And that's a real challenge.
I would assume that eradication or massive removal of AWDAD would not be received maybe that well. How is it received? Has it been kicked around in the state of Texas? Is it something that you guys have talked about? And how is that received, and how do you deal with that? I mean, is it even something that is even on the table?
Yeah, it's again, in that particular case where, you know, at least a portion of the range of desert bighorn sheep is on private lands, the private landowners would have the opportunity to undertake that. And so, you know, there are landowners that prefer the native resource, meaning the desert bighorn sheep, and that are engaging in some management of AWDAD like that. And so those conversations are taking place. And I think these last few years that Kevin mentioned, and really the sort of the ultimate downturn there in the sheep population, wild sheep population in Texas, has gotten a lot of attention as to, do we really care about this resource? And you're sort of at a fork in the road. And if the fork is yes, we have to take the ultimate action to see that through, because there's not a maybe in that. It's a yes or it's a no. And if it's a no, it's a no. But if it's a yes, what are we going to do? And that really does involve intensive eradication of AWDAD. And that looks like a number of different things. But there are those that are willing to have those conversations. And I would foresee that landowners are willing to take those actions into the future. And like any land management action, you know, conservation is expensive, period. If it's prescribed fire, if it's, you know, providing water in an arid landscape, it's a remote place to get to. It's hard to get there. It's helicopter, it's truck, it's big water hauls, whatever it is. And it's working in big landscapes, you know, and in this case, it would be a very difficult and probably really financially burdensome thing to do. But yet, if there's a desire to get it done, it can be done. And so I guess I'm sort of answering your question a little bit in a long circuitous route there, but those conversations are taking place, and there are those that are willing to invest in desert bighorn sheep in that way.
You know, but the other side of that coin, and bad pun, is that there are some landowners, large landowners in Texas that don't have desert bighorn on their places, but they can damn sure sell a lot of oddhead hunts. And so it's a revenue stream that some of them don't want to give up, and then some of them really needed it to stay in the ranching business. So we get that. So we co-sponsored and were involved with a symposium in Lubbock maybe 3 or 4 years ago this month. And I know there's another one coming up in Alpine, Texas, but landowners, you know, 97% private ownership of lands in Texas, obviously they're at the center of this conversation, and some want oddhead, some want desert bighorn. It's really hard to have both.
Right. Yeah, it's a lot. There's a lot to consider. I don't want to spend like the entire time talking about everything that's wrong with sheep, because certainly there's a lot good going on, I would assume. So I wanted to give you guys a chance to talk about what is going right with sheep. Where is, you know, the strongholds for sheep? What's going good with them? You know, where, what populations are doing well, and what kind of cool projects are you guys working on to ensure that we've got, you know, sheep on the on the landscape, and that they continue to, you know, prevail. So I wanted to give you a chance to talk about some of the good things as well.
I'd love to talk about nothing but good stuff, but there's a couple others that I need to at least mention here. You know, if you look at doll sheep in Alaska, the white ones up there, Alaska is probably down 40 to 70% on doll sheep numbers in some of their mountain ranges. And of course, that's reflected in the harvest. The ram harvest the last two falls has been as low as it's ever been recorded in the last 30, 40 years up in Alaska. And so what's going on up there, a lot of it is weather dependent. With, you know, not trying to point a finger at, you know, who's responsible for changing climates, but the recognition that climates are changing and weather patterns are changing. So to me, the classic doll sheep range in Alaska might have had dry, powdery snow that would wind scour and blow off. But now it's heavier moisture content. And with freeze-thaw, rain on snow events, it sets up like concrete, and they simply can't paw through it to get at that grass that's underneath there. And so doll sheep numbers in Alaska have gone down dramatically. Now, how do we change the climates and the precip patterns and those rain on snow events? And we don't know. We don't know the answer to that. Alaska's documented an ascending brush line, and sheep are primarily grazers, but the brush line is climbing up the slope a meter a year. So the top of the mountain's not getting taller, but the brush line is getting higher, which reduces that habitat.
That probably brings up predators a little bit higher too at the same time.
You bet. And so, you know, we've talked about, well, what do you do in Alaska for doll sheep with an ascending shrub line? Well, you could do contour prescribed burning, but which mountain range do you start on in Alaska? Holy cow. You know, and so there's challenges all over wild sheep range in North America. You know, Nevada for a long time had the most of anywhere, over 12,000. But I think 3 or 4, maybe 5 years ago, when things really started getting dry in Nevada, I've heard numbers from Nevada Department of Wildlife that they think they lost 2,000 to 2,500 desert sheep because of this ongoing chronic drought in Nevada. Wyoming, where I used to live and work and manage sheep, is down from what it was. Some places, Oregon, Oregon's doing really well, especially their what they call California Bighorns. They're not from California, but it's a really cool idea that's in early stages. But California Bighorns were first brought into the U.S. back in 1954, the year I was born, from the Junction herd around Williams Lake, B.C. And they made their way into 7 western states and Oregon, Washington, Utah, North Dakota, blah, blah, blah. There's a bunch of them. But the source population, the Junction herd, is really struggling. And so I know there's a lot of conversation, a lot of effort in how could Oregon pay back the favor that British Columbia did 70 years ago? And so there's some hurdles, there's some pathogen profiles, there's some, you know, work that needs to be done genetically. But we think that would be an absolute great accomplishment 70 years later to, hey, British Columbia, the Western states are paying you back because you got us in the California Bighorn sheep business. Now we want it. Because Oregon is doing well, they've started issuing ewe licenses in some of their herds to, you know, keep a cap on numbers. And so there are some places that are doing really well. Others, the struggles continue. North Dakota is a great example. I was just at a meeting in Minneapolis a month ago, and Brett Weedman, the biologist, the Bighorn sheep biologist for North Dakota Game and Fish, a longtime friend and colleague, he reported, you know, they've got 350 to 400 sheep in North Dakota, and they're doing great. They don't have a ton of habitat, but they're doing great. Rams are growing, lambs are growing, and so there are some bright spots, certainly, but there's plenty of challenges, and I guess on balance, there's probably more challenges than there are bright spots, but that's what we keep trying to do with our membership and our network of chapters and affiliates. They're dedicated conservationists. We want to see wild sheep prosper, and, you know, it's so heartening for me over my 45-year watch of FNAS and the Wild Sheep Foundation membership. There's people that may never get a chance to hunt a sheep that still want to do something to help wild sheep. So they may help on a guzzler project. They may help tear down some fences. They might help, you know, weed pulls on crucial winter ranges, that kind of thing. So it's a great family. We have 11,000 members roughly. And a lot of those folks may never hunt a sheep, but I just love them for their energy and their willingness to donate their time and as our boss says, time, treasure, and talent in the purpose of helping wild sheep, back to the motto of putting and keeping them on the mountain. So.
Yeah, wild sheep's always been one that I've loved supporting. I've been a life member for 12 years now.
Thank you.
I will say that, like, the magazine itself, like, if you guys like reading, like, the magazine's worth it every single time. I love, you know, your articles over the years. Read a lot of those, and just like even the, you know, sheep show every single year. That's like one of my favorite things to go to. Best, probably the best show around. It's just a good time. And it's like cool seeing everyone there supporting wild sheep, and, you know, what everyone wants to do is put more sheep on the mountain and keep them there. So it's like, yeah, it's cool. Like I've done a lot of these also guzzler projects around here, just like seeing these guys who literally talk to, like, they go to every single guzzler project every year in Nevada, and you ask them, they ever drawn a sheep tag? They're like, no. But they keep going back. They keep giving their time. They keep giving their money. Like, it's a good thing to, you know, motivate me, you know, to be a life member back in the day. Like, I might never draw a sheep tag here in Lower 48 or even Alaska go to. And it's like, I'll continue to do it.
I think, Brady, to your point and to Kevin's point, there's such a really unique interest and generosity of the community that supports sheep conservation. And what percentage of that will ever hunt a sheep, I don't know that number. And it's probably inconsequential because it really doesn't matter. The point is there's such a generous nature of people that come to the sheep show and support, or they support through their time and talents and treasures a work project through a chapter and affiliate to build a guzzler, or they activate and engage in a policy matter because it involves sheep conservation, sheep management on public lands or a particular bill or policy or whatever it might be. But it really is unique. You know, sportsmen as a community, and I hate to say this, but it's the truth, and I've said it for my own career, there's such an apathy with sportsmen to not engage in so many matters, but yet in a really happy turn here that people willingly support and they come out. And I think one of the reasons too, folks are willing to support Wild Sheep Foundation is because there's such transparency in where the dollars go, to your point. I mean, the publications that come out, you can see literally a portfolio of this is where every dollar was spent with a state, provincial government, Mexico, Central Asia, whatever the project might be. And this is what was accomplished. And it's very strategic. It's not haphazard. It's reviewed well by conservation staff and our professional resource advisory board, ultimately confirmed and approved by the board, working with all of our conservation partners. And so there's such strategy and delivery to the projects. And again, sure, they're addressing challenges, but man, there's such a sense of generosity that really is encouraging in this community.
To that point, I'm interested, and I'm going to, I apologize, Corey, I'm going to mute your mic real quick, cause I think that's where I'm getting some reverb, but I'm curious as to hear you guys talk about what you think the role of hunting is in conservation, specifically to wild sheep. There's obviously a lot of issues with them, and it seems like we're constantly kind of struggling to keep, you know, populations healthy and growing and, you know, expanding. Certainly there would be people, probably nobody that's going to listen to this podcast, I wouldn't think, but there will be people that say, why are you hunting them? Right. If there are these issues, these conservation issues, but I'd be curious as to your thoughts on hunting and the role that hunting plays in sheep and sheep conservation.
I'd love to take a shot at that. And so I go back again and give credit and recognition to our founders. And these were experienced sheep hunters, maybe international sheep hunters. That back, and the story goes, on a snowy February weekend outside of Madison, Wisconsin, at a cabin in Mount Horeb, a dozen or more of those early sheep hunters and their spouses gathered and said, we've had a great run. There's no way that sheep license revenue will ever pay for sheep conservation. So we need to do something. And that was the birthplace and the genesis of the Foundation for North American Wild Sheep. The story went, they all threw $100 on the coffee table and said, all right, we're going to start a wild, you know, a sheep foundation, kind of like Ducks Unlimited, but for mountain sheep. Okay, that was in 74. By 77, we were incorporated. And now 48 years later, you know, we've raised and directed over $150 million to wild sheep conservation. One of the things that we did a decade ago, Clay Brewer and I worked on it, and then Clay took another swing at it last year, is we looked at every jurisdiction, every state and province that we could get data from, and we asked, I think, four simple questions. How much money do you spend every year on wild sheep management? Might be surveys, disease research, whatever, but what are your wild sheep costs every year? Where do you get that revenue from? What percentage of your wild sheep management program is paid for off of wild sheep license revenue? And across the board, and averages being what they are, a decade ago, we found that 74% of the money that the agencies in the West used for their wild sheep conservation management programs came from auction and or raffle. There's some states that they just don't issue enough licenses. And I'll give you a good example in South Dakota. When they still have a draw for a bighorn sheep license, I believe they were issuing two resident-only licenses at $275 a piece. Well, double that, $550 in license revenue. Now, South Dakota Game, Fish, and Parks, here you go. Here's $550. Have a sheep program. We all know that didn't go very far. And so our Midwest chapter, based in Minneapolis, worked with some of the leadership in South Dakota, and they have now a special, a lot of people call them governor's permits, or basically a conservation permit that gets auctioned with those proceeds invested back into the resource. I always say invest in the goose to keep laying the golden eggs. And so if it was 74% of the costs were paid for by auction and our raffle a decade ago, Clay's worked last year, and it's still preliminary, but it said 83% of the costs are paid for by auction and or raffle. And so our founders 50 years ago could see that license revenue was never going to pay the bill because of the cost and care and time and attention you got to put into these mountain sheep. And so that was pretty visionary. And so we, you know, the Wild Sheep Foundation, and not including our chapters and affiliates, and we've got a network of 36 of those sprinkled around the country and overseas, we were providing 40% of the money just ourselves. So, you know, we try to put our money where our mouth is. And so I would characterize us first and foremost as a wild sheep conservation organization that is absolutely pro-hunting. And, you know, I was a wild sheep manager for decades. As soon as I retired, I went sheep hunting. And, you know, I spent way too much money. I'd just gotten divorced. I spent a ton of money in 3 years, but my kid got to go with me, and I was able to hunt in different places and get nice rams in each spot.
Based on what you're saying and what I'm hearing, would we have wild sheep on the landscape without the permit program as far as the auction or raffle programs? I mean, it sounds like we would have some, but it sounds like it would be really, really tough to keep those populations persisting on the landscape without that program.
100% absolute in my mind. They would not be where they are today without that. And, you know, there's criticism that, only the rich, you know, the rich guys get to hunt these. But when I look at, again, I use examples. When I look at South Dakota, the first year that the South Dakota tag was auctioned, and there were South Dakota residents that were like, we don't want some SOB non-resident coming in here and buying our tag and hunting our sheep. It was a resident of South Dakota that said, I'm getting up there in years. I want to hunt one in my home state. So I think that individual paid $102,000 for the first South Dakota bighorn tag. And it was like Midwest chapter of Wild Sheep said, South Dakota Game Fish and Parks, here's all that money. Now go have a sheep program. And through the years, it's been almost a dozen years now, they had great success. And they went from 2 permits up to 8, and we're headed towards more, but now South Dakota's having a respiratory pneumonia die off in a lot of their bighorns. And so I think total hunt licenses in South Dakota might be 5 or 6, where it was 8, maybe headed to 10 or 12. And so to me, if the agencies, and I worked for an agency, and I work with a lot of agencies, Corey worked for an agency, if the agencies do the right thing with those funds and invest it back in that resource and in that goose to keep laying that golden egg, it's a great model. And we see this application in Central Asia with conservation permits. And so, but it's really up to the agency to do the right thing for that resource with that money. Corey, would you agree or disagree? Oh, you're muted.
I would 100% agree with that. I mean, you take, just to use a, you know, kind of an average number, 75% of someone's budget, think about what they can accomplish, right? Again, from a survey and a management standpoint, I mean, they would be significantly crippled in the ability to do their job. And when you look at the hunter's role in that conservation, I'd add one more sort of side tenet parallel to that from a funding standpoint, is understanding the financial contribution of an organization like Wild Sheep Foundation, again, to the state fish and wildlife agencies through our grant and aid program. You know, significant dollars, millions of dollars on an annual basis are provided with and through our chapter and affiliates programs to these state, First Nations, provincial governments, et cetera, to deliver meaningful conservation programs. So again, the basis of that, it's by and large hunter-funded dollars going another mechanism to reach the resource. So there's a lot of streams there, and the nexus of all of that is the hunter conservationist.
You bet. The Pittman Robertson matching funds. You bet. So.
You guys sound like you like your job. Do you like your job? I mean, it sounds like fun. I mean, it sounds like this is the fun thing about the job, is like getting to talk to people, you know, from different backgrounds that work for different agencies or organizations. And it's always fun when you feel the passion for the resource and for the job that you're doing come through, which obviously I'm feeling from you guys. So, you know, just, I guess I say that a little bit in jest, but I genuinely feel it coming through the internet and through you guys' voice. It's easy to tell that you're super passionate about wild sheep and about the job. And, you know, we certainly appreciate what you guys did. I mean, this little project that Omar had originally, when he kicked around the idea, he was like, yeah, I want to run 100 miles. And then he came back and said, you know, I think maybe it would be cool if I could do something with this, you know, just kind of a jump off. And so I thought it was really fun that you guys jumped in on it. And I think it's going to bring a lot of awareness to sheep. I think obviously Omar is way more invested than he probably would be if he was just running 100 miles by himself. And I talked to him about that the other day. I said, you know, when you were going to do this on your own, you know, obviously you had a little bit of pressure, but now you probably feel a lot more, because now you got to deliver, because there's a whole bunch of wild sheep that are waiting on you, right? So it was really cool. Go ahead.
And I'm not sure which of Brady, it might have been you, not sure who first talked to Keith Balford, who's our marketing and communications director on our staff. But he came to us and said, hey, I just got a, you know, email from these guys. Here's an idea. And, you know, I'm three quarters joking when we said, God, we'd pony up the money if we didn't have to run 100 miles through the desert. And so, but we thought, how cool is that, you know, that a guy like Omar, you know, a fit young man that's willing to do this for a cause. And so we said, well, you know, they're taking pledges, kind of like the old walkathons, you know, well, we'll give you a dollar for every mile you walk. It's like, no, let's go big. And so we talked about it on our staff, and our boss was somewhere in Canada, so we just made the decision without him. It's like, hell yeah, we're in. And so he came back and he's like, great. But yeah, this is a kind of project that helps identify the need, explain it to people. It's like, well, why would that guy run 100 miles across the desert to raise money for wild sheep and water development? There's an opportunity for us to tell that story. But I'm quite sure we didn't want
Did they give you the name of the guzzler? Did they hit you with the Lopez Sheep Cantina, is what we're calling it?
Well, naming rights are a big deal, huh?
Yeah,
I think the project does a number of things. Like you say, I mean, it meets a resource need, right? We've talked about an arid landscape, and you know, one of the great things about that, again, these are, you know, in this capacity of the financial support from Wild Sheep Foundation, largely hunter-funded dollars, and there'll probably be others. Maybe they're all hunters, maybe they're not. But the point is you have a resource here that's going to support all kinds of, from herp to fauna to birds to obviously big game in this capacity. But then you have what I think was a really cool aspect of it too, and I really commend Go Hunt and Omar, that you're creating awareness around a need and an issue from the running community, some probably that have some awareness of it and some that don't, because it's not what they think about every day. And so it's a really cool project. So really tip my hat to you guys for thinking like that, because there's an educational component to this, and that's really big too for us.
You know, one of the things I think is notable is, you know, I mean, Corey used to work for an agency. I used to work for an agency. Maybe you guys have an agency background, who knows, but you know, we don't anymore, but they're our partners. And so if they need help, we're here to help them. Our chapters and affiliates, closest to, like Nevada, we've got 6 affiliates in the state of Nevada. And, you know, what we want to be able to do is, in this case, help Nevada Department of Wildlife. They've got some real challenges going on now with this chronic drought, poor forage availability, population density. You know, I guess it's fair to say you always want to use sheep alive if you can to transplant them to suitable habitat elsewhere. But when you can't, the Wild Sheep Foundation, you know, we have policy statements. We recognize the need to sometimes harvest ewes as a population control option. And so we're here to support Endow as they make their decision on what are they going to do with this acute situation in Southern Nevada with a lot of sheep and not a lot of water and not a lot of feed. And so, you know, we're not driving the bus, but we're damn sure putting the gas in the bus so they can drive it. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, we appreciate it. We appreciate the partnership, obviously. You know, this is the first chance I've had to meet you guys, but it's always a little awkward when you do a podcast like this online, right? Because there's the delay and the echoes and things, but I would love to have you guys in sometime just to pick your brains even that much further. Open invite, if we can get you to Vegas sometime and we can sit across from each other at a table and kind of further flesh out. And I'm speaking for Brady, and I think he'd probably be okay if I say this, but Brady is a genuine nerd when it comes to diving into the details of biology and habitat and sheep and populations. And I know for a fact he would love to have you guys in office and get a chance to sit down and like really pick your brain and kind of explore that. So open invite. We'll have to get you guys into the office here in Vegas and we can do this again and really hopefully raise more money and more awareness for wild sheep. And just like you said, keep putting gas in the bus because it requires gas to keep it rolling for sure. And I think it's,
you know, in
it's
the spirit of wild. Las Vegas, we could bring that 10,000 and gamble it and double down and we could raise 20,000.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. That's like when I was a kid, my brother and I had a lawn mowing business. My dad would periodically go to Las Vegas and he'd say, "Do you have any money you want me to invest for you?" And we'd give him like $10 of our hard earned money. He'd come back and we'd be like, "Well, how'd it go?" He goes, "Oh, I did okay. You guys lost." But what I was going to say is I've referenced a couple times, and Corey has too, this chapter and affiliate network we have. And I look at the Fraternity of the Desert Bighorn, which is the oldest. They predate the Wild Sheep Foundation. I think they're having their 56th or 57th banquet this year. And I want to say it's May 20th at... They typically have it at South Point, but Fraternity of the Desert Bighorn, FDB is what I always call them. You know, they've got a tremendous bunch of volunteers on their board. One of their past president, Clint Bentley, he's now bumped up. He's on the Wild Sheep Foundation National Board. Pat Cummings is the president of FDB. Pat is a retired wildlife biologist for Endow right there in Las Vegas. And, you know, a whole roster of volunteers, but their banquet is coming up. So maybe that's something you guys can connect with locally there in Vegas. But right now, between January and May is what we call the show season. And our chapter and affiliate network is having banquets all over. I think Gray, our boss, is headed to Alaska today or tomorrow. And so Utah just had theirs. You know, Wyoming's coming up. So that's where people can really engage. You know, of course, we're interested in having folks be members of the Wild Sheep Foundation, and ideally they could help their local affiliate or chapter as well. And so there's local events on our website, and we can get that information to you for the fraternity. But that'd be a good opportunity for you guys to talk. And they're putting on a banquet, so I'm sure they don't necessarily want to deviate too much from that. But those are the guys that boots on the ground closest to these projects.
Yep, for people listening to, I pulled it up. It's a May 17th Fraternity Desert Bighorn Banquet. And we actually do have a table there too. So we go and bought a table, so we'll all be there. And yeah, if anyone wants to chat with us about anything or, you know, ways we can continue to help fraternity, like we always
say, love those guys. Bit often.
Exactly.
Yeah, but that'd be great if we could ever cross paths in Vegas. I was there. Of all things, I went to Las Vegas July of last year to a Garth Brooks concert. Mm-hmm. It was only 118 degrees. But I thought, to go see Garth Brooks, I will suffer through that.
Yeah, open door policy. If you ever make it back, let us know. We'd love to jump on and have you to the office and get a chance to meet and talk further.
So let me verify, when is Omar's run? When is he doing this?
It's May 2nd and 3rd, I believe. Let me pull it up to be sure here. Yeah, May 2nd and 3rd. So we're running it up on the Salt Flats and Salt Lake. So I'm not doing a whole lot. I'm just going to help Omar pace a little bit, but he's going to be doing most of the work. But I hope I can get a good 14, 15-mile run with him in the dark or something like that to help support him. But yeah, he's a beast. I saw him running last night, and I like waved across the street because he was running the opposite way I was running. And he was so locked in. He didn't even hear me waving or yelling or anything. And I was like, Omar, he's like, yeah, I had a run for the sheep. I'm just in the zone.
We teased him about the Wendover Salt Flats and the land speed record.
Yeah.
It's not too far from that Newfoundland range, right? So you've got California Bighorns there in the state of Utah. So relatively close. Those guys could actually probably nip out and look at some sheep if they had some extra time after it was over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How many people are going to do this run?
I can't remember what he said that usually do this race.
I wanted to say there was like 35 or 50, something like that. I don't know how many crazy people there are that sign up to run 100 miles in the desert, but apparently there's a few of them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we joked again. We sent our $10,000 pledge over to you guys last week on a wire transfer, but we said maybe we pay half down and half if he finishes.
Exactly. That's how I was joking, Omar, too. You got a lot riding on you.
I like that.
Great effort.
He's been putting in the miles for sure. If he's not at his desk, he's running.
Yeah, I think the last 2 weeks he's literally averaged over 100 miles each week.
Wow.
And that's a lot. Like a whole lot of miles.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's serious commitment. 100
miles in one day. Yeah, big commitment.
Yeah, we'd look to share, you know, the social media stuff, and I'm not that wizard, but if we tag or collaborate or share or whatever we do to help tell that story, it's a great effort and also a result in a good project. So have you guys, we're just curious, you know, talking to some of the Endow guys, they're water development specialists, they're Brad Bauman, guys like that. Have you guys located a spot that you're looking for?
Yep, we actually got a spot in the Muddies, so the Muddy Mountains right here would be really nice because it's right outside of Vegas. And I think we actually bumped or made our project earlier, so we actually did get a slot in 2026. Originally, we had thought we probably could do 2027. So hopefully we're going to, like we said the other call, we're going to try to do a big film around this whole thing. We're going to film some of the race, film the Guzzler project, and you know, try to put a big little piece out there about this, you know, big conservation movement we're trying to do. And other people get excited about as well.
Yeah, we had a big project with the Fraternity of the Desert Bighorn a year ago, February, right after the 24 Sheep Show. And Vergara, who's a Spanish rifle maker, they have not only helped sponsor the Sheep Show convention, but they wanted to help on a project. So they gave us a chunk of money. We matched it, got with the Fraternity and Endow, and came up with that big project, and they put together a really cool film that tells the story. And so Keith was on that project, but yeah, we'd love to come whenever it's scheduled in 26. We'd love to have some representation there as well.
Yeah, let us know, please.
Yeah, definitely have to stay in touch. Yeah.
We appreciate you guys jumping on. We won't keep you any longer, but like I said, open door policy. We'd love to have you anytime. And if we can, you know, work together and do more projects, we would love to do it. We appreciate what you guys are doing, and we appreciate your time today. So thanks for jumping on, and thank you genuinely for the donation. And, you know, it's going to be cool to see the Omar Sheep Cantina put in the ground.
La Campana.
Yeah.
Appreciate you guys. Thank you all very much.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Hey, yeah, take care.